This is the weekly show all about weather, weather brains. This is episode number 373 for the 19th day of March, 2013. We are like, as we do the show, we are within 12 hours of the beginning of spring. The vernal equinox is just about here, and we're glad you're with us. Thanks a lot for taking the time to listen. I'm very excited about this week's show. We've got some great stuff to talk about, a great guest, but we got some regulars out. You know, for a lot of people, this is spring break where people are like out, and we've got Bill Murray out. We've got J.B. Elliott out. We have Brian Peters out. However, the best looking guys are still hanging here, including Kevin Selly, who is our neighborhood crank in Dallas-Fort Worth.
What? All of those guys are 100 years old each. That has nothing to do with spring break for them. It's not like they're on vacation.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like they don't have any kids in third grade.
That's right.
It makes no sense at all.
But, yeah.
I've got a child.
I'm going to leave. See ya.
Yeah. But they started, you know, when I grew up, everybody had one spring break week in the whole state. And now every school system is different. I mean,
right. Mm-hmm.
So it's just,
we can't
strange.
Even get the spring breaks for the public school systems here in Raleigh to line up with NC State spring break. So if you're, for example, a parent who's a professor at NC State, you're hosed.
Oh, boy. Well, Kevin, what's happening in Texas? Anything exciting?
A couple of thunder showers in central Texas. Nothing too big, although there is a watch box up. And I'm thinking maybe our guest looks as though he's in a bunker somewhere ready for some severe weather.
He knows something we don't.
Yeah, well, he would know before anybody else. So,
yeah, I'm excited about our guest. But Nate Johnson is with us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Nate, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. We had a severe weather day here yesterday, and we'll talk about that. I'll talk to Chuck about that because it was very interesting from a science perspective, from a communication perspective, from a social science perspective. The deal yesterday was very interesting, and watching the reaction today has been fascinating, and we'll talk about that.
I'm very much looking forward to that conversation after we got it started on Twitter. Should be a good one.
So who has the honor of introducing our special guest?
He literally may be one of those that doesn't need an introduction.
Yeah.
I think anybody who listens to this show with any regularity knows who he is. And he's already been on a couple of times. So,
And I've already noticed, Chuck, we've got probably one of the highest numbers of viewers right now watching this live. Most people listen later to the audio version, but we have spiked on live viewers thanks to your name and your presence. So we are honored, sir, to be in your presence, the legendary Chuck Doswell in Oklahoma. Chuck,
yay.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
We're good. Okay. I like that skull. What are you wearing there? Let's see that shirt. What do you got, a NSSL shirt? What is that?
It's hang on. I'll get up so you can see it. It's a Tessa shirt.
Oh, Tessa,
nice.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
The reason I think your live listeners may have spiked is they're probably waiting for me to say something outrageous.
And that's the reason we want you on this show. And I will say this is the first.
The outrageous things that Kevin and I say aren't nearly outrageous enough.
We get a break tonight.
Yeah.
So this is the first time I have not seen Chuck in the cowboy hat. I mean, is this a new look or what?
Well, I don't wear it all the time.
Okay.
And besides, like I've got
Burt Reynolds.
Now. I bought a cavalry hat, but I'm not going to show it.
Show it off. We need to see it.
That's
Come
another
on.
Story.
Okay. Well, Chuck, we're just all going to ask a series of questions here. And again, say anything you want to. And by the way, we are broadcasting live on a cable outlet in our market as well, just to let you know.
Well, I'll see what I can do about destroying that.
You know, if I get fired, I get fired. It's been a great career, and it's been wonderful. But I want to go back, because really, you know, I've never really talked much about your background in terms of what got you into this. So what got you into this? Was it a weather event or something else?
No, I really have no specific thing to point at that says this is what got me into it. My earliest memories of being interested in the weather go back grade school and maybe even earlier than that. Always fascinated with the weather. And I especially was fascinated with photographs that I saw of tornadoes in various places. And just thinking, I really want to see one of those, and I want to know what those are all about. And that sort of drove me in the direction that I followed. So it wasn't any specific event.
Did you grow up in Oklahoma?
No, no. Well, I'd like to think I never grew up at all. But at least I got older and graduated from high school in the Chicago, western Chicago suburbs. And that was not a good place to watch the weather. And so I was constantly frustrated with that. I ended up at Wisconsin for undergraduate school. And while I enjoyed Wisconsin a great deal, I hated the winters. And it really wasn't a severe storm place. I got a great education there. I'm not sorry about having spent 4 years there. I drank a hellish amount of beer. and fertilized a lot of lawns on the But after that, I went to Oklahoma, and I think that was when I really felt like I'd arrived at a place that was more suited to my interests. And I did both my graduate degrees there. So here I am.
What are your three degrees in?
All of them in meteorology.
All of them meteorology.
Yep.
Now, and you had a hitch in Vietnam, right?
Yeah, I was invited to participate in something. I got a letter from the president.
And a guy you were barely old enough to vote for.
Yeah. Well, it's actually, I was old enough to vote then. I was in grad school when that arrived. In fact, master's degree and had one semester of coursework on my way to a doctorate when I was invited to, without the option of saying no, to participate. And so I spent 2.5 years in the Army. And that's kind of a long story. But when I got back, I just went right back to grad school and completed my PhD.
Why did you go all the way to the PhD? Why did you think you needed that?
Well, there were at least two or three compelling reasons. One is that even relatively early in the process, I realized that was the ticket, the price of admission for doing what I wanted to do, which was research. And secondly, I wanted all the education I could get. I was like a sponge, and the more they threw at me, the more I wanted. And they finally reached the point where they said, well, we can't do anything more from you, so we're kicking you out. And so then they turned me loose on the world.
Did you teach regularly?
Not so much. I'm not really a faculty research kind of guy. I've been associated with the university as an adjunct faculty member for many, many years. But my main research time was spent with the federal government, first at the Severe Storms Forecast Center in Kansas City, then the so-called Weather Research Program in Boulder, Colorado. And after that, I went to NSSL and have been here in Norman ever since. I retired in 2001 from the federal government, and I'm now a part-time researcher with the so-called Cooperative Institute of Mesoscale Meteorological Studies. And essentially, I'm on soft money. Right now, I'm being paid for 4.4 hours per week, and so I don't necessarily show up at the office all that much anymore. But it's been great. I get a chance to corrupt young minds. And I've had some wonderful colleagues. So it's been great.
Chuck, I guess you've come up with a modern conception of the supercell. Is that right? Would you claim that as your own?
Les Lemon and I wrote a paper that was published in 79, and I can hardly take all the credit for that. It was a genuine collaborative effort. Working with Les was a terrific experience. And I learned a lot from him, and hopefully tried to help him learn some new things too. But we were probably the first to make a significant modification to the supercell model that Keith Browning developed in the early 1960s. So I guess I would say I'm responsible for an important modification of the model that Keith Browning developed.
And let me just say for everybody watching this that, that maybe you're not directly involved in the science. This guy has really shaped everything we do. So much of what we know we can trace back to the work of Chuck in the 70s. And, you know, I know that Browning was involved way back before then. So this is fascinating stuff, and that you're basically listening to the father of all of this this concept. What have you learned? What's the biggest thing you've learned since the late 70s when you kind of took Browning's concept and came up with that supercell model you guys had in the 70s?
Well, when I first began my work, I was really zeroed in on tornadoes and supercells. One of the things that's happened to me over time is my interests have continued to broaden. And I would certainly say I'm not on the cutting edge of storm-related research anymore. I've left that to younger, more energetic folks. That's fine with me. I've probably become much more concerned about sociological issues in the expression of weather forecasts. And so apart from writing review papers, which once you just start doing that, everybody and his dog wants you to write a review paper for them. In fact, Chester Newton warned me about that years ago when I was working in Boulder. Once you start review papers, it's hard to stop. But since then, I think I've broadened my interests a lot. Been involved in tornado databases and the historical record of tornadoes and how that might relate to things like climate change and so on. By the way, I just got invited to be a reviewer for the International Journal of Climate Change.
Wow.
Just very strange, but apparently I'm going to be slated for that. But and then I got into forecast verification and how best to do that. I'm not sure I've contributed a whole lot, but I've learned a lot working with some very bright people like Harold Brooks and Barb Brown and so on. Really smart.
Now, I'm curious about the forecast verification stuff, because as we, you know, it's really easy, I think, to verify or to attempt to verify a forecast that's you're going to get this much rain on this day and the high is going to be this and the low is going to be this. But as we shift toward a probabilistic you know, based way of communicating forecast information and the associated uncertainty that goes with it.
Right.
How can we best verify forecasts? And the way I look at this, I look at Nate Silver from the New York Times, who's done this big, you know, he's applied his presidential guessing or presidential modeling to try and figure out who's going to win the presidency and win the various states. He's applied that same sort of approach to the NCAA tournament. And my alma mater has something like a 7/10 chance of winning the championship. And so let's say they go all the way and they win the championship. Everybody's going to say, well, Nate Silver's prediction was wrong because he predicted everybody else to have such a higher thing. But yet that's not how we would grade that. What's the best way to do that in terms of not only picking basketball teams, but, you know, weather forecast, probabilistic highs, lows, severe weather chances, things like that?
Well, there's a pretty well-established method, a whole series of techniques for verifying probabilistic forecasts. Probably the most important concept is the so-called Brier score, which essentially measures the difference between what you forecast and what happened. Now, of course, for things that you were talking about, like temperatures and precipitation, we have direct measurements of those quantities. And so we could, in fact, say the degree to which a forecast is right or wrong is measured by the difference between what the forecast was and what the observation was. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about a probabilistic issue, then there's another whole issue that springs from the fact that a probabilistic forecast, a single probabilistic forecast, is neither wholly correct nor wholly wrong unless it is for 100% chance or zero. So anything in between, the real measure of success in probabilistic forecasting is a quantity called reliability. And that is keyed to the notion that if you make a whole bunch of forecasts of something happening with a certain value of probability, say 30%, you would expect a reliable forecast. Every time you forecast a 30% probability, there's a 30% chance it'll actually happen. In other words, the climatology of the events matches your probability. It's reliability is sort of the main goal of probabilistic forecasts. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to explain to people that probabilistic forecasts, a single forecast, is neither wholly right nor wholly wrong. And it's very hard to wrap your head around that if you're JQ citizen. Well, it rained on my 10% forecast. Yeah. Well, but look, 10% of the time we expect that to happen.
Yeah. In that thread, though, what are your thoughts as we are becoming more and more able to go to look further and further out in time? The GFS goes to 384 hours. is that the right thing? People have come on the show like Jeff Cravens and Todd Foisey and said, you know what, maybe we should be coming back the other direction and doing a better job closer in time.
Well, that there's a whole series of questions implicit in your question.
So pick one, Kevin. Come on.
well, he laughed at 384, so I guess he's not in favor of that.
Let me suggest that sure, we can make forecasts out to 384 hours, but the question is how accurate are those forecasts? And my guess would be, without having done the rigorous work to validate it, that they're probably no better than climatology at that time interval. And in fact, the default value for a probabilistic forecast when you don't know anything, if you're sitting there in your forecast office and you're looking at the maps and you're just totally confused and frustrated, you haven't got a clue what's going on, what you should forecast is climatology. Mm-hmm. That should be your forecast. That is a know-nothing forecast. And so if it's, say, a 20% chance of showers and you forecast a 20% chance of showers, then you are saying, I don't know anything about this forecast. I have no clue how to distinguish between this and any other randomly selected day at this time of the year. So that's a favorite rant of mine. Mm-hmm. I drive through a lot of the country, especially when I'm storm chasing, and I hear a lot of forecasts on the radio. And in the plains over much of the region, you're driving along and they say, oh, there's a 20% chance of afternoon and evening thunderstorms. What that says is we haven't got a clue.
Mm-hmm. And now, let me stop you there. Let's talk about summer convection. We have that problem here where we are, Chuck, in the summer. We don't have a clue. I have no clue where and when it's going to rain on a summer day at 7 o'clock in the morning. Do you see any hope for this to improve in the next generation?
Well, let me back up a little bit, and I'll duck your question to a certain extent. I'll return to the plains. And say, when we talk about the plains, which I know something about, whereas I don't know much about Alabama weather, on the plains, we can do much better than that. And it turned out that a fellow named Lynn Means showed in the mid to late 40s how to forecast thunderstorms in the plains. It was essentially tied to the low-level jet stream. And if you had a thermal boundary and you had a low-level jet stream impinging on that boundary, that would elevate your probabilities of that day. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have that, then your probability should go down below climatology. Now, I'm going to say what I do know about the Southeast is that you get the dreaded, quote, air mass thunderstorms.
That's what I'm talking. I'm talking about the storms of July and August. These are air mass storms that happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
And in that case, my primary recommendation, if you don't know, if you don't have any good reason to depart from climatology, climatology is the right thing to forecast.
And that's what most people, that's what most people do here. Every day in July and August, you're going to hear us say hot and humid, and a few spots are going to get a thunderstorm today. But what that's people want to know, Joe Q Public, they want to know when and where will it rain? And I can't help them. Nobody can help them.
My favorite statement on that subject is that people in hell want a glass of ice water too. You know, are they going to get it? No, they're not. It would be wonderful if we could do better than that.
But see, you're the smartest guy I know. I'm putting it on you to figure out the problem of air mass thunderstorms.
Well, I don't even like the term.
Well, what term would you use?
Okay, I would just say ordinary thunderstorms, and they are not random. Okay, if you perhaps do some careful mesoanalysis, you might find some reason to elevate your probabilities above or to reduce them below climatology, but probably not by far. They're just ordinary thunderstorms, but we don't have the information to be able to anticipate exactly when and where they're going to be.
And you know, the way it works, you can go back the next day and do a really good quality mesoanalysis, and you can find some reason in a lot of cases, but you can't do that in real time. It's just not happening.
If climatology is 20%, you might say 30%. Because we have this mesoscale boundary here, or I see this pattern developing in a certain way, so it's negative, so we're going to go lower than climatology. We're only going to go 10%. But you can't play very much at a high level of confidence, and so you wouldn't want to depart from climatology by very much. But there are potentially reasons to depart from it. You just have to be... you have to work very hard, and you're still going to be wrong a lot.
And now you say you don't like the term air mass storms. I want to know, Chuck, what you would call an air mass storm.
Well, the classic thing that people refer to is when there's no front around, when there's no large-scale boundary, there's no large-scale weather system producing it. It's in a region of more or less uniform meteorological setting. And it just sort of pops up here and there. And you know, the reasons for it being here rather than there might be something very subtle, some local topographic feature. The wind on that day might favor a storm on this topographic feature rather than some other one. But that's on a scale that's very hard to pinpoint. So that's
I cannot get him to say it. I have baited him. I have baited him, and he will not say it.
Okay. What do you want me to say?
Well, I attended the weather conference for undergraduates at the College of DuPage back in 1990 something.
Okay.
It was the first time that I had met you in person, and I remember you. This question came up because it's a severe weather conference, obviously, or severe weather workshop for undergrads.
Yeah, one of Paul Cervetka's things.
Exactly, and somebody asked about these sorts of storms, and I believe you referred to them, and correct me if I'm misquoting you here, as air mass bird fart thunderstorms.
Okay. I might well have used that term. It's one of my favorites, actually.
He's and denying it.
Let me go back into the research days a little bit. You're formulating thunderstorm structure prior to Doppler radar. Once the Doppler radars started spinning, what were the biggest surprises when you saw the data from there?
Well, I've not been particularly surprised by anything I've seen on Dopplers over the years. I think the biggest shock to many people was how frequently storms have mesocyclones in parts of the region other than parts of the nation other than Oklahoma and Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
I think we found that supercells occur at some frequency pretty much anywhere in the country. They may not be as common as they are in, say, Oklahoma or Kansas or Nebraska, but they do occur. And in fact, what I've seen from the Doppler has suggested that storm structure and evolution pretty much is very similar from one part of the country to the next. You want me to get off on a rant? I could go on about the so-called notion, which I believe to be utter nonsense, that storms in the southeast are different. You know, apparently, you know, rain falls up in the southeast, or
there's some. This is getting good. You go for it, man. The floor is yours. We want to hear it.
And that stuff really pisses me off. And in fact, there's been an effort to siphon money from the federal government into studying southeastern storms as if they're some sort of different phenomenon.
Ooh. Where's Tim? We need Tim Coleman here.
Yeah, perhaps you do. I've had some discussions with Tim, and we've obviously agreed to disagree. But
maybe that's why we haven't seen Tim in a while.
I put a presentation together where I had an example of the Tuscaloosa tornadic storm, the supercell, from 27 April 2011, right next to the May 3rd, 1999 Oklahoma City supercell. And if you can tell there's a substantial difference between them, you're probably taking LSD. Those two storms are pretty much identical events. The same, if you put the same ingredients together in Oklahoma or Alabama, you're going to get the same storm. And the idea that Alabama storms or Mississippi storms somehow are these mysterious entities that don't match anything anybody has ever seen, that's just horseshit.
Okay, well then where is that perception coming from?
Well, it's coming from a lot of people. I had a chance to work with a couple of people whose experience was from the southeast. Dave Imey, who retired from the Storm Prediction Center, had been in Jackson, Mississippi for many years, and we'd had some discussions about those storms. And when we looked at storms, I think I convinced Dave that the same basic principles were operating. The conditions are a little different. I mean, you have lower cloud bases, higher humidities, less visibility, more haze, more storms at night. But I think the storms, especially the tornadic storms, are essentially the same.
Well, would you agree with the statement that there are more HP supercells in the southeast as opposed to LP?
Probably. I don't know that for an actual fact, but it's likely. Given the high humidities, yeah.
But that's not that different physics are operating in the southeast. That's an issue of the typical environment you find in the southeast is more Absolutely. Supportive of HP Absolutely. Versus LP in the plains.
And also the LCL heights are probably lower here, I would assume, in the southeast.
Yeah. Which makes the likelihood of tornadoes from a supercell higher.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get a supercell, you might have an enhanced probability of a tornado.
Why do people fight about this Tornado Alley thing? And I've seen a lot more sniping about that. And I'll be the first to say, I will bait people sometime to get an argument going. But, you know, everybody in Dixie... No, I've never done that before. But everybody in Dixie Alley say, ooh, we have more, you know, tornadoes, large violent tornadoes per square mile than Oklahoma and Kansas. And everybody in Oklahoma and Kansas says, those guys don't have any issues there. Well, why do people fight about this? What? Who cares?
Well, first of all, Tornado Alley is not a scientific term. It's a media term. Tornado scientists spend very little time worrying about where Tornado Alley is.
Where did it come from? Do you know the term?
We thought you came up with that.
Shit. No, I try to avoid creating new terminology if I can. That's before my time.
Do you know where it came from?
No, I think it's a media creation. I think somehow the press felt obligated to describe the region of high tornado frequency as Tornado Alley. I don't have a problem with there being an alley of high tornado frequency in Dixie. And I don't have a problem with the idea that it might contain a higher percentage by some margin, perhaps not large, but some margin, of violent tornadoes. Certainly, I think it contains more nighttime tornadoes, which is really scary. And it's also clear that the Southeast has a higher propensity toward fatalities from tornadoes. I don't think there's any doubt of that. That's a matter of what the record shows. So I don't have any hang up with that at all. If you want to call it Dixie Alley or whatever you want to call it, I really don't care. Because as I say, as a scientist, we're not particularly interested in what you call it. We're interested in studying the events and their climatology.
So you talk about not calling things things. That leads us into one of the bigger issues of the day. And a particular national cable outlet has taken it upon themselves to name winter storms.
Oh, good.
This is going to be good. I can tell you right now, this is going to be really good. Go ahead, Nate.
Now you're amongst friends here, and you know, we don't there are not a whole lot of fans of the naming of winter storms, at least by the Weather Channel in this room, although I'm sure there are a few that are listening. What are your thoughts on that? And both from a, and I'm going to try and take the Weather Channel out of this.
What
is naming naming winter storms a good idea, a bad idea? And let's assume that we decide to do it, that the Weather Service is going to do it, and we're going to have a National Winter Storm Center, and it's going to be in not Coral Gables, Florida, to name these things. Is this a good thing? Is this something we should be spending our time on?
Well, I think the answer, I spent some time talking about it in a recent blog I posted. The rationale used by the Weather Channel for creating winter storm names, I can't quote it directly, but they were making some claim about being able to provide better service to their customers as a result of naming a storm. That is utter fabricated crapola. There is no conceivable way that naming a winter storm provides a better service to the customers of any weather service, Weather Channel or otherwise. We've been perfectly content to refer to storms as the East Coast Cyclone of September 15th, 1982. That's not a problem. We don't have to call it Irv or Bill or Marie.
That's <Uh-oh. bullshit. laughs>
Frankly, I don't think the Hurricane Center needed to name tropical cyclones, but, you know, that was something they chose to do. And by now, it's so thoroughly entrenched, people would freak out if you proposed to eliminate it. But it serves no valuable purpose. It's just
is it doing any harm? Let's put it that way. Is it doing harm?
Well, that's a kind of a flimsy justification for doing something. That it does no harm, you know.
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm reversing the question to see if it's causing a problem. Because one of the things is we've discussed about is that there's probably a chance for more confusion. And then it starts to mess with the historical record as well.
Yeah, well, it might. It's not obvious to me it does some horrendous disservice. It's just pointless to me. And if there's no reason, good reason for doing something, then why do it? I mean, to justify it on the basis that it does no harm is just not going to cut it as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, your buddy Harold Brooks just sent out that tweet. He says, disturbing image, Chuck Doswell on Weather Brains making all three of us giggle like schoolgirls.
So. Well, I have that effect on people from time to time.
So that it's an interesting question because it's something we've talked about a lot is you know, is it a good thing? And is the Weather Channel the right group of people to do it?
Well, it's clear to me that the Weather Channel did it purely for marketing purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to show themselves. Oh, we're the world leaders and blah, blah, blah. We're trying to serve the public. And this is going to help the public. I don't think it's helped the public, and they're not world leaders at anything.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a problem with their trying to, you know, with their trying to make a buck. And I mean, they're a private company, and they have a right to try and earn money just like anybody else. But I think the thing that rubbed me the wrong way was how they did it, and then the fact that they're just not calling a spade a spade.
Right. Well, but you know, the primary reason, I think, beyond any question, is marketing. And it's hard for me to believe that marketing offers anything of value to anybody other than them. I haven't got a problem with them making a buck. That's fine. If they can convince people they've done something wonderful by doing this, fantastic. But it's
all right, let me ask you this. So this is something that really bothers me, and I'm not going to go into a tirade about it because I've done it enough. So The Weather Channel has their own proprietary tornado. What do they call this thing?
Torcon.
Yeah.
So they come up with this number, and right. I don't, you know, and so all the, you know, for all of us that do local weather. People that use the Weather Channel, they ask us, what's a Torcon for today? I don't know. I don't even know what that means. What do you think about these guys issuing these proprietary indices that are mysterious, good or bad?
Well, I think it's horseshit. I you know, we have a couple of local prima donnas in the Oklahoma City metro area who are very fond of such sort of exercises. I wouldn't mention any names, but one of them has been around a long time and appeared in a lot of movies.
We're never going to get Gary on this show, but go ahead, man. Go.
He developed his own calculated tornado probabilities that he was putting out for a while.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow. So this is not, I thought that was the first this has ever happened when the Weather Channel started doing it.
Oh, hell, Gary's a pioneer, don't you know? I mean, he's a freaking genius.
Was he, I'm ignorant of this, but what was he, did he publish the formula by which he came up with those numbers? Okay. I just checking.
And in fact, I'm pretty sure I have some sub rosa evidence to suggest he probably stole it from some of the guys who now work for Weather Decision Technologies.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. Well, so let's talk about the state of the tornado warning and the severe weather warning process. You know,
I'm delighted.
We had our big outbreak was 2 years ago, April 27th, 2011. The death toll in this state alone, where I live, was 252 in one day.
Yep.
Which to me is unacceptable. Where does the watch warning process stand? How's it working? Why did so many people die, in your opinion, that day? You've looked at all the data.
Well, and you chose not to show up at the Mississippi State. Where I basically said, when you put large violent tornadoes through metropolitan areas, you're going to kill people. And especially in places where construction standards are really not very good. And a lot of the homes that were hit were probably not much better constructed than mobile homes. With those kinds of conditions, tornadoes moving at 60 plus miles an hour, it's very difficult to convey to the general public by any product we now have that today, if you don't do something and follow our guidance and take it seriously, you have a good chance of being a casualty. and perhaps even did. I don't know how to say that. I often wondered when, given the hyperbole of the news broadcasters in Oklahoma City, I remember asking myself, what happens when we have a really big tornado? How do we differentiate that between the fact that any thunderstorm approaching Oklahoma City sounds like the mounting and riding of the Four Horsemen? These guys make it sound like the end of the world is coming when a storm approaches Oklahoma City. So I was wondering, what are they going to do? Well, what they did, and this is really subtle. First of all, they were showing live video of the tornado approaching, so there's no longer any discussion about whether this is a real threat. Second, the tone of voice and the sense of urgency that they created, I think, had a big effect on people. And so it turned out that on May 3rd, 99, they actually managed, in spite of themselves, to be wildly successful at helping people make decisions about that storm. In Oklahoma City has been struck more than any other metropolitan area in the United States. And so you don't have to sell tornadoes to Oklahoma City. I would guess, without knowing for sure, you probably got to do a more aggressive job in Alabama. I have a suspicion that there's a certain amount of complacency. It can't happen to me, and if it does, it's in God's hands. There's nothing I can do, blah, blah, blah. All these potential sociological factors contributing, plus the fact that when you get tornadoes, they're often fast moving. They're often hard to see. It's late at night in some situations. You have a lot of handicaps in the Southeast. And so I find it not surprising that you have so many fatalities. That over 200 fatalities is, of course, an unacceptable number. But what I want to tell you, you haven't seen the worst that can happen. We are sitting in a situation, the state of warnings is, to kind of bring it back to the question you originally asked. Although I haven't got the basis to make a quantitative exact statement, I would say that watches and warnings have successfully saved tens of thousands of lives in the time that's elapsed since the 1950s when they were first reinstated. So the system is working, but there are certain circumstances where nothing we can do is going to make much difference. Imagine the tornadoes of 27 April 2011 coming on a day in October or November in Tuscaloosa when that stadium is packed with football fans. And you have maybe a 10 to 20 minute warning. What in the hell are you going to do?
What are you going to do? So here, let me throw that back to you. All right, I'm the athletic director at the University of Alabama. I've got 110,000 people in that stadium.
And you have a guy working for you who makes about 10 times what you do.
Exactly. but I get a tornado warning, and what do I do? What do you do in a venue like that? What's your advice to the athletic director?
Well, my advice is to listen to the lawyers, okay? And I just had an opportunity to listen to a lawyer. Wait a minute. This isn't as funny as it sounds. The lawyer said, okay, the legal responsibility of venue managers is the following. If a reasonable person could anticipate that possibility, the law says that venue manager is responsible for developing a plan and implementing that plan. If he does nothing, then he is liable for everything that happens. You can imagine we are looking at the possibility not of 100 fatalities, not of 200 fatalities, thousands of fatalities. Many of us in the severe storms community lie awake at night tossing and turning in absolute fear of that event. And the really worrisome thing is that what we know about storms and how we understand the climatology is that it will happen. Mm-hmm. Not if it happens, it will happen. And when it happens, are we going to be ready?
Probably not.
Probably not.
But the what can you do? I mean, I'm on site down there at the University of Alabama football games every fall, and I'm there. I do a little update on the scoreboard, and if something happens, I'm there. What would you do? I mean, what do you tell people to get out of the?
Meteorologist can't do squat. The best you can do is what you can do as a meteorologist. The challenge is not to you; it's to the venue managers.
Yeah, exactly. So what can they do?
The answer is not what any of them want to hear. If you look at the average ticket price for a Saturday afternoon at Bryant-Denny times 100,000,
right.
And you face them up and say, look, you're in a hatched region with a 35% chance of a significant tornado within 25 miles of here. You think they're going to stop the game?
Of course not.
But that's the answer. I mean, if you want the sure answer, that's it.
So here's where we're at. If you think 200 was unacceptable, you're not going to like what's going to happen when that happens. And the idea that we could not have such an event happen is a good reason for complacency, but it turns out to be completely false. It is entirely possible. If we wait long enough, it will happen. And I can see that now, and I think all of you can see that now. It's very easy to understand that, and we can't do anything about it. All we can do is talk to the venue managers. I just spent a few weeks ago talking to a whole collection of them. I think we scared the shit out of them, and I hope we did.
Good.
But think about something like Bonnaroo, this big music festival in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
They've got, you know, vast numbers of people. There is literally nowhere they could go.
Yep.
What could you possibly do?
And when you had a situation like that with the Indiana State Fair a couple years ago,
right.
You had the warning. You knew there was credible evidence that you were going to have a problem, and it just took the wheels of the organizers and the concert promoters and the State Fair Commission and everybody else to get all on the same page to decide, yeah, we are really should tell people what's happening and at least let them make their own decision, which they didn't do until it was nearly too late.
That is a tragic story. And the more I've learned about that, we talked about it in our meeting with venue managers quite a bit. The big problem was the stage was constructed such that it was only capable of resisting a wind of 25 miles an hour. All right, what's the reasonable probability of a wind exceeding 25 miles per hour in Indiana at that time of year?
You get higher than they counted for.
It's almost guaranteed.
Yep.
And yet, they had this very flimsy structure. By the way, I was unaware of the fact there is actually a building code for stage structures.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, they didn't follow the building code. And, you know, there's a whole list of problems with that Indiana State Fair event. We had three very similar events happen within a short time in that year.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them were eminently preventable.
Yep.
By a reasonable person.
Let's change directions here. Let's talk about storm chasers.
Hold on. I don't want to leave this yet, because I think the question that you wanted to ask when we got on this was about tornado warnings and severe thunderstorm warnings and the issue that arose yesterday.
That's on my list.
Turn to that. Let me comment something. And I know James has talked about overwarning. from the Weather Service. And I think with some justification. All right. But let's think about what the Weather Service confronts. The fact is that there is an asymmetric penalty. Nobody dies if a tornado doesn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
If a tornado does occur and there was no warning, then you have federal investigative teams looking over your shoulder. Weather Service forecasters are not stupid. They understand that asymmetry. And what does the fact that we produce only yes-no warnings, either a warning was or was not issued, that's the only option we now have. That almost guarantees, well, in my view, it does guarantee a bias toward over-forecasting. And we can argue about how much that bias varies from place to place. There is some evidence that, for example, central Alabama has a serious overwarning problem compared to other parts of the country. Let's think about levels of threat. If you're looking at a Tuscaloosa-type storm, okay, if you're looking at spotters reporting a tornado on the ground doing big damage headed toward a metropolitan area, you would put out the highest possible threat levels for people in the immediate vicinity of that storm. Would you not?
Yes, sir. Right?
All right, you're looking at a squall line, and there are some bumps and wiggles along that squall line that look like they might be line echo wave patterns or whatever jargon you want to throw at it. There is a non-zero probability of a tornado. In fact, it's higher than climatology at that point. Even though you don't know that there's a tornado, you have no spotter reports, there is still a significant tornado threat there. Do you want to issue nothing? Does that really make sense?
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Let's say we have a...
Let me finish.
Okay, go ahead.
What I want to be able to do is tell the public that there is a threat, but it's not an extremely high threat in that kind of situation, rather than saying it either is or is not a tornado warning. I want to be able to express, I call it graded threat levels. And I think the idea of graded threat levels is a wonderful idea. I'm very much in favor of it. And I have a suspicion that properly trained and calibrated weather forecasters can do that effectively. I know everybody is afraid of the dreaded P word, probability. But I think that's the way we should go. Probability is the language of uncertainty. We want to be able to tell people our assessment of the weather. And our assessment of the weather always includes uncertainty, does it not?
It should.
Yeah, well, whether we say it or not, it always includes it. We feel it. That's why the yes-no decision is so difficult to make sometimes. Because
would you say that the yes no decision, would you change the current warning structure to go to some type of graded threat level system, a new message type?
I want to do that, but not until, first of all, we know how best to do that. And at this point, I haven't got any magic bullet formula that would tell people what is the most effective way to express graded threat levels. We, you know, the May 3rd, 99 event triggered the so-called tornado emergency concept.
Mm-hmm.
We have used and abused the tornado emergency. Its verification record is abysmally bad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that's not some sort of magic bullet, in spite of the fact that the central region is going ahead with this incredibly stupid impact-based warning experiment this year. It's the wrong thing to do. We're doing it prematurely, and we're using the public as guinea pigs for our experiment. I think that's totally the wrong thing to do. Let's get it right before we change it. First, do no harm.
Do you have, based on what you've seen to date, do you have any direction that we should start looking for these, you know, how to express this grade? You say we don't have a magic bullet. Do we have an, even a direction we should start walking?
Well, you're a meteorologist, right?
Sometimes. I've been called worse.
What did you study in school? You studied math and physics. Mm-hmm. You learned how to draw weather maps, and you played around with QTs and blah, blah, blah. All right. How much did you learn about, say, communication theory?
Well, that's why I'm going back to
school. How much sociology do you know?
Yeah, that's why I'm in school for a master's degree now. And well, even after some of that, I'm still sort of scratching it.
I don't want to convert meteorologists into sociologists. I want to say, let's let the experts do that. Mm-hmm. In cooperation with us, we can work with them. Mm-hmm. People who already know how to do this sort of stuff, people who are trained to deal with the sorts of issues that we learned nothing about. Let weather forecasters be weather forecasters. Let somebody else worry about how to tinker with the wording of the warnings to be the most effective. By the way, speaking about that, if we want to reduce the toll of fatalities from tornadoes, is changing the wording in forecasts likely to represent some sort of sea change in the response? I don't think so. There's a massive public education program that we need to do to try to get people over their persistent complacency. The idea that, hey, this doesn't mean anything to me. It might happen to somebody else, but it's not important for me. We had a fascinating event happen yesterday in Alabama. You know, I've seen James postings on it. Power outages over vast areas of the state from what apparently was not a tornadic storm. A severe thunderstorm. We've reached the point where everybody seems to ignore severe thunderstorm warnings. They've become meaningless. There's something seriously wrong with our system if that's the case. But I don't know how to fix it. I studied equations and learned how to write computer programs and stuff. I'm not the source of wisdom on this topic.
Is the Weather Service lagging in the social media and the mobile space as far as warning people?
Well, of course they're lagging. What is the Weather Service about? The Weather Service is about weather forecasting. They don't know squat about sociology. And the idea they could hire a sociologist and somehow solve all their problems is nonsense.
So why haven't they put out apps and things?
Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons for why the Weather Service does things, and
AccuWeather.
Some of them are understandable, and some of them are not so understandable.
Well, let's hear some, because I'm completely perplexed, you know, and Nate jokingly says AccuWeather, and I know AccuWeather, you know, put up a fuss some years ago with regard to this, but, you know, well, under that logic, the Weather Service wouldn't have been allowed to have a website. And so I think it's kind of
didn't want them to have one.
Well, and it's kind of interesting today to see that the Weather Channel wants to have the TLD.weather. But I don't understand. I mean, who cares what AccuWeather or the Weather Channel thinks? If you're the Weather Service and your mission is to protect the public and inform the public and protect, what is it, protect life and property or whatever their mandate is, right, and you're in a position where your budgets are under scrutiny and you've got to talk about cutting services and not filling open positions and things like that, I would think that you would want to be moving full force into every possible avenue that fulfills your mandate of informing the public, and that these days is mobile and social.
Yes. Well, there's no question of that. I agree completely. But we live.
Well, why don't you fix it then?
We live in a world where politicians.
He's getting paid for 4.4 hours a week, Kevin. There's only so much the man can do.
If you start paying me, you know, a big bucks, I'll see what I can do.
Let's get a Kickstarter. Kickstarter
that's
going.
What, yeah, that's what it. Soft money is all about, Kevin. Yeah.
We need a Kickstarter for Chuck to go kick some you-know-whatty up in Washington.
I'll write that proposal tonight.
Well, seriously, I think the Weather Service is ill-equipped on their own to do anything about these really important issues not relating to actual weather forecasting. One can debate whether they're doing anything anywhere near what they should be doing when it comes to weather forecasting. Don't get me started on training and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But part of that is distribution.
Yeah. Well, dissemination is part of this.
Right.
Of course, we always have the glorious weather radio, which is pathetic at best.
But it seems like a natural extension from that. You know, I mean, we joke about it, but it's been around. So, I mean,
And you can tell what kind of market penetration it has.
Right, but it's a natural extension. So weather radio is now, you know, argue whether it's been good or bad over its history, but it's now no longer useful. But the natural evolution then is to distribute in new channels. So I just don't understand why that's so difficult.
The idea of new and the bureaucratic bozos that populate Weather Service headquarters, those are incompatible notions. They don't
Now, you know what? You're right. There are, what do you think about this? Several people who've come on this show and then other people who, you pay attention to and you hear rumblings that there are forces within the Weather Service, probably younger, who are wanting to move in this direction. Sure. It's just that they've got to wait for a certain level of bureaucracy to rotate out of the system.
Well, and when I was in the Weather Service, I can remember we were sitting around saying, all we got to do is wait for the current generation of old folks to die off. You know, and here 40 years later, guess what?
We're still waiting.
They're still there. We just replaced one generation of old farts with another one.
There's the title.
Why is weather radio not county-based or storm-based?
Well, the big problem with storm-based warnings is that the media has been slow to respond with software to display storm-based warnings. It's easier to just use the existing software to use county-based warnings. So as far as the public is concerned, what they see is the county-based stuff. And I don't know all of the details about what's going on in weather radio, and frankly, I don't really want to know. Because to me, weather radio was irrelevant 20 years ago. It never was going to have the kind of market penetration it needs. It still doesn't. It never will. But I think some of these new avenues are very promising. It's just that, you know, I would guess that there isn't anybody at the helm of the ship that really knows very much about how to do that and so on. Hmm. And the Weather Service has a long history of trying to do stuff on their own, where they take some meteorologist and say, you know, build this system, even though it has nothing to do with meteorology. And, you know, they ended up with crappy systems as a result. That's pretty consistent. They just don't know how to deal with innovation. And I don't think they ever will, frankly. There are individual people in the system who are capable of dealing with it. But I don't think most of them have any chance of ever getting into a position of power and authority. Those kinds of people pretty much torpedo their advancement above lead forecaster position.
So we got 10 minutes just for time's sake here. So Nate, you go ahead and finish, and I want to talk about chasers, but you go ahead, Nate.
All right. So one last question of the Weather Service: 20 years from now, are we going to have one? And if we do, what does it look like? Because I've read, you know, there's a lot of talk about how the models are going to replace some, you know, forecasters, some or all, you know, that forecasters will shift into more of a QC role on a day-to-day basis and you know, spend more of their time.
Weather Service, I think the fact is that it'll probably be a situation like the firemen on diesel locomotives. We're going to have people that are in jobs who are essentially caretakers of automated systems. Mm-hmm. If you look objectively at the existing forecasts, Weather Service human forecasters are essentially not adding value beyond day one. already, and there's even some debate about day one. I think you could automate the warnings. As shitty as the algorithms are, you could probably automate the warnings right now, and nobody would know the difference. In many places. I think the Weather Service has essentially abdicated its responsibility, but it'll hang around for a while because, you know, there's still a lot of good people in there trying to do good things, and they'll continue to get it to hang around. What the system should look like, I don't know. Does anybody really give a shit enough to pay for what it's going to take to get improvement over the models? I don't know the answer to that. The models are going to continue to get better. I can promise you that. Everything we do in an objective sense is going to improve. If we invested one-tenth of what we're currently investing in improving the models and all of that apparatus, that objective apparatus, we could have better human forecasters. But I'm told that I'm being impractical.
All right, so Chuck, let's talk about the state of storm chasers 2013. Soon, tornado season, May, June, you're going to be flooded, inundated with all these guys out there. What do you think of the storm chasers today?
Well, the storm chasing community, such as it is, hasn't really changed much since we started way back in the 70s. It's always been a diverse group of people. And there have been some people who are willing to do things that others are not. There are some who are responsible and some who are not. When you have a distribution and you have a larger number of people, you're going to get more and more people out on the wings of that distribution. So we have people who are essentially crazier than anything I saw. But if you looked at what I saw in the 70s, you could predict that such crazy people would appear. I wasn't smart enough to see it, but it, you know, looking back on it, I should have anticipated that. Chasing has become something that I really am not very happy to advertise that I'm participating in it.
Now, do you still go out, Chuck?
Yes. Yes, I go out in stealth mode.
Is the fundamental problem that there are too many of them now? Is if the distribution of the crazies hasn't changed, there's just too many of them?
Yeah. Essentially, it's become a trash sport.
You think there's some way to fix that?
Nope.
Because there's some lawmakers who suggest you need some sort of a permit or something.
Well, how is that going to work?
I don't agree with it. I'm just bringing it up.
I just don't think that makes any sense. And you know, there are probably going to be laws passed that are essentially unenforceable.
Right.
But they're going to try to enforce them anyway. I've seen police very upset at what they see happening in front of them with respect to chasers. So I have no doubt that police responses are going to become more and more aggressive. My goal as a chaser now is to be invisible. I don't want to be known.
So you go out in total stealth mode. I mean, what are you wearing? Yeah. A camo outfit and a nose and glasses? What are you wearing when you go out there?
I just wear what I normally wear. I just don't put light bars and decals and storm chaser logos on my vehicle. I just try to stay as anonymous as possible.
You got that hat, man. If people see that hat, they know you're there.
I don't wear that hat when I'm chasing, James. Okay. That hat is really impractical on a storm chase.
That thing might blow halfway to Omaha, you know?
Absolutely.
But what do you think about the guys that are selling these tours? You know, they have the big tours and they charge $500. I mean,
well,
good, bad.
I'm a member of one of the tour groups. I go out with a bunch of tour group clients for one chase a year, every year. And I have a blast with that. And I think our clients have a lot of fun. We do so in a way that's very safe. We don't take what I consider to be unnecessary risks. And I get a chance to expose people who have been fascinated with storms all their lives to what storm chasing is really all about. And, you know, we offer an authentic chasing experience, which includes, needless to say, a lot of frustration, a lot of driving and seeing nothing.
And cheap hotels.
Yeah.
And bad
food. On a good size supercell thunderstorm within 30, 40 miles of Oklahoma City.
Oh, Judas.
How many vehicles, not your chase group, but how many vehicles total are on a storm these days?
I would guess over 100.
Wow.
Wow. Mm.
And what gracious. Was it 30 years ago?
One.
Wow.
All right, so we got like 5 minutes. Chuck, what is the greatest mystery in this science as far as what you think now? What's the one thing we've yet to learn that we have to learn?
Why do most supercells not produce tornadoes? And I would meld that with the question, why does the atmosphere need tornadoes?
Mm.
And nobody really has the right answer to that. If you don't, nobody does.
Nope. I've been asking it, and people tell me, you know, that's a bullshit question, you know. Well, maybe you think so, but to me, it's an important question.
Mm-hmm.
I think the atmosphere does not do random. Okay, things happen in the atmosphere for a purpose, for a reason. Tornadoes do something. We just don't know what. And I think if we could answer that, we might understand better why most supercells don't produce tornadoes.
What would there be any value, and I'm just making up numbers, let's say we triple the number of balloon launches and do so four times a day. Would that help or would that not help?
Well, there's no question it would help. If you go into any scientific field experiment, the first thing they do is get more soundings.
Right. Because that's been my question for a long time. Well, when people ask me about similar things, I say I just don't see quantum leaps until we see better continuous monitoring. A lot of those technologies have not necessarily even been invented yet.
Well, the technology of soundings is just not very sexy. It's old and it's well understood. And it's not terribly expensive. And yet somehow it's always on the chopping block for budget cuts.
Right. I'm thinking of things that maybe like the wind profilers, but that could do more, could somehow figure out temperature and things like that.
The wind profilers here, that was an idea that no self-respecting meteorologist would ever suggest was not a great idea to have wind profilers. Mm-hmm. And yet our experimental profiler network is vanishing even as we speak, and not scheduled to be replaced.
Is there work we using LIDAR to supplement that or no?
No.
It didn't work out or just
nothing scheduled. Of course it worked. They just
getting funding.
They're the victims of the budget.
Right.
And of course, Weather Service management, bloated bureaucracy that is inside the Beltway. I could detonate a 10-megaton nuclear device inside the Beltway and save a whole bunch of money for the weather. not degrade services at all. In fact, services would probably be improved.
Chuck, who are some of the people in this science that you look up to, that you admire, that do serious research meteorology, the people that you look up to?
Oh, Paul Markowski, Harold Brooks. Let's see.
What's the status with Mr. Moeller?
Oh, that's a very sad story. You know, he has Alzheimer's.
Right.
And the last time I went and talked with him, he looked me in the eye and he says, "Do I know you?"
Mm-hmm. That was hard, I bet.
Yeah, and that was devastating. Yeah, Al is certainly one of the people that I've looked up to for a long time. And the bad things happening to him are just terrible to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, we got to wrap this up, Chuck. I can't thank you enough for being on the show. If somebody wants to, you mentioned, you know, you do the tour thing. You want to give a plug. You can plug anything you want to here. You still doing your show with Gene Roden? I mean, this is your chance to plug away.
That show is temporarily in abeyance, and I have no likelihood in the immediate future it'll be resurrected. We'll see. Gene has had a number of problems. and really can't devote the time to the show that he needs. I chase with Tempest Tours, run by Martin Licious, and I chase with them because Martin and I agree on how best to chase. And so I'm not ashamed to be associated with a tour group that has their ethics. So
I, well, everybody's loved having you on the show. One guy on Twitter just said, you should let this guy talk as late as he wants. I think everybody will stay up all night to hear him. So,
well, I'll be happy to come back.
All right. Okay. Well, awesome. Well, Chuck, thanks again. And again, we look forward to talking to you again real soon. And thanks for what you've done for the science, the knowledge you've given all of us, and for getting a lot of us started in our career. Thanks.
Well, thanks to you for all the things you've done for the people of Alabama.
Okay, Chuck. Thanks a lot. Have a great night.
Good night.
Okay. Let's do this. Boy, these hangouts, when you disconnect, ask these hard questions. All right, let's take a quick break because we're bumping up on news time. We are going to go through WeatherBrains 101, This Week in Weather History. We will come back and I'll kind of give it to you guys. I'll do my pick of the week and you guys can take it from there. But let's start right now with WeatherBrains 101 with the good professor.
WeatherBrains 101 with Professor Peters.
The last few episodes have taken us on an in-depth review of information about the new dual polarization upgrade to the National Weather Service Doppler Weather Radar Network. Boring. So now let's turn our attention to something a bit less technical, like weather folklore. People often dismiss weather folklore as little more than a grab bag of sayings, tall tales, legends, old wives' tales, and superstition. Folklore is considered by some to be the opposite of science. But actually, folklore and science can have more in common than you might imagine. The scientific method is based on observation and evidence, but so is weather folklore. Now, for some folklore, though, the conclusions they make are sometimes off base. So how about getting a temperature reading? Crickets chirp faster when it is warm and slower when it is cold. Now, actually, there is some truth to the fact that crickets can serve as thermometers. Tradition says that if you count the crickets' chirps for 14 seconds and then add 40, you will obtain the temperature in Fahrenheit at the cricket's location. Yeah, that's right. Remember, that's the cricket's location, not yours. Now, perhaps you don't have any weather instruments, so this one might help. When windows won't open and the salt clogs the shaker, the weather will favor the umbrella maker. Well, now this one does hold some truth. Windows with wood frames tend to stick when the air is full of moisture as the moisture swells the wood. This slight change will make windows and sometimes doors more difficult to budge. By the same token, salt is very good at absorbing moisture, so it clumps together rather than pouring out. Both of these observations indicate that the air is laden with humidity, so there is a greater likelihood of precipitation. I have a real problem with this one, though. I have aluminum-framed windows, and my salt shaker sits in an air-conditioned house. If you have a question about the weather, drop an email to question@weatherbrains.com.
There are four watershed years in American history, in my opinion. Obviously, 1776 was a critical point in our history with the Declaration of Independence. I think 1865 was another major year with the ending of the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln's plan for restoring the Union derailed by his assassination. I think 1968 was another year where America had its eyes opened by the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, sandwiched in there was 1932. The United States and much of the world was mired in a deep depression that was threatening the very base of our economy. A critical presidential campaign was just kicking off, and totalitarianism was coming to the forefront in Europe. Headlines on the morning of Monday, March 21st, 1932, in the Birmingham Age Herald were dominated by the threat of an Irish Civil War and the Japanese aggression against China and Manchuria. No one wanted another world war after the horrors of the first one. Alfalfa Bill Murray, the Oklahoma governor, was kicking off his campaign for the Democratic nomination for president with a stop in Birmingham. Nationally, it was becoming apparent that New York Governor Franklin Roosevelt was the favorite for the nomination. The kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby was getting less and less publicity as the trail of the kidnappers went cold. Locally, the big news of the H. Herald Cooking School that will be held at the Bowell Auditorium. The Birmingham Chamber of Commerce was leading a jobs drive for local unemployed. There was a banking crisis with bank failures piling up. People were being urged to stop hoarding money at home, put it into circulation. There were initiatives nationally to bring the issue of prohibition to a vote, and it was becoming clear that when this happened, the Wets would win. In sports, Babe Ruth has signed a one-year contract with the New York Yankees for the unthinkable sum of $75,000. Now, the Birmingham weather forecast at the bottom of the front page said simply, increasing cloudiness, showers in the north, Tuesday rain and colder. The day before, Palm Sunday had been the finest weather day in recollected memory across Alabama. The landscape was blazing to life with bright yellows, pinks, lavenders, and new green growth. The U.S. Weather Bureau office in Birmingham was located in a fine building on 13th Street North in the Fountain Heights neighborhood. Mr. E.C. Horton was the chief of the office. He was the James Spann of his time, quoted by local residents regularly and revered as the man who, quote, makes the weather. On the morning of March 21st, it was cloudy when he made his morning observations. The wind was blowing out of the south at 12 miles an hour. The temperature was 62. The dew point was 54. By noon, it would be 70. The dew point would have risen to 64, and the barometer had dropped to 29.72 inches. And Mr. Horton coded his observations with the ingenious code used by the U.S. Weather Bureau personnel. He rushed it to the telegraph office. All over the country, 200 observers were doing the same. Operators would transmit the observations during a short period after 7 a.m. when all the lines would be kept open for such an operation. They recorded all the other observations around the country in order. This information was rushed to Horton, who charted them on a map. Big high-pressure cell was over New England, but of more concern to Horton was a low between Oklahoma City and Fort Smith. The low was very intense, with a minimum pressure less than 29.20 inches. Warm, moist air was being drawn northward. Horton drew the 70-degree isotherm from northern Texas into southern Arkansas and southern Mississippi. Now, many people knew that it was tornado weather, but Horton couldn't use that word in his forecasts. It was banned by Weather Bureau policy. His morning forecast called for thundershowers, then colder Monday night. That was all the advance warning that Alabamians would get as its worst natural disaster began to unfold. But Alabamians were no stranger to severe weather and tornadoes, and many had an uneasy feeling that morning. The first tornado touched down around 3:15 in Marengo County. It would cut a 7-mile path passing just south of Demopolis and killed 7 people. At least 14 more tornadoes would snake from the sky that deadly afternoon and evening across Alabama in 3 waves. At least 8 of the tornadoes are regarded to have been violent, F4 or greater. The death toll is elusive. The official toll is listed at 268. But reports indicate that the actual toll was closer to 300. It would be the deadliest day in Alabama weather history. And we commemorate it here over 80 years later. That does it for this edition of This Week in Weather History. Follow my weather history tweets on Twitter. I am WX Historian at Twitter.com.
Hey, we're going to do that email thing right now because we're in a hurry here.
Letters. We get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters.
Well, good news is we don't...
What's going to happen here? Because I got to go do some television. I'm going to throw in my pick of the week totally out of order, and then you two guys have it. The show belongs to you. This is my pick of the week, and then we'll get back to the email segment. I think the SPC guys have done something cool with the mesoanalysis page. Almost everybody listening to us has probably used the SPC mesoscale analysis site, but now they have a new little option. It says double-click map for climatology and environmental breakdowns. And it will go in and show climatology when tornadoes and certain events have happened and where the current parameters are in relation to climatology. It is marvelous. I mean, that is one of the coolest little tools. So check out the SPC mesoanalysis page and double click on that map and you'll see how that whole thing works. So having said that, gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Wow. All right. Can we get Chuck back?
All right. Well, let's take a look at the email. Not a whole lot of email this week. So if you're listening, and there are certainly more of you listening this week than in previous weeks, thanks to our headline guest early on, send us an email, email@weatherbrains.com, or you can go to the website. You can tweet us. You can Facebook us, what have you. The listener comment from James in Roanoke, Alabama. And Kevin, He's asking about Radar Scope for iPad. I'm a big fan of the Radar Scope family of products. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's a must-have for anybody. Go ahead and do the, and I'll make my comment after.
All right. Also, we have a couple of listener surveys.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had more on that particular thing.
No. It was just the iPad.
I was just going to say, my supervisor here at the office, I got her on that. She fought me tooth and nail, saying, oh, I can't use something that you other guys use and blah, 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 blah. And I finally got her to put it on her phone. And, you know, I mean, it's a $10 app. No, that's the, how much is it? The Radar Scope?
No, the Radar Scope for iPad's like 10 bucks. It's the Mac version that's more expensive.
And so we went round and round and round. She has the iPhone version, but went round and round. I finally got her to do it, and she lives and dies by it now. Mm-hmm. She has a family member who travels in between Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston, and she tracks him every step of the way and uses that thing all the time. Every time there's an update, the second an update comes out, she comes into me and says, okay, how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I do the other thing? And she is not... every time she comes into the office and I start talking weather, she always looks at me and she says, Charlie Brown's teacher. You remember that? Because when I start talking weather, that's what she says she hears. And so she is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a weather weenie, but she is absolutely hooked on Radar Scope.
Yeah, it reminds me of a story. It used to be that, you had to have $100,000, radar display from Barron or somebody to be able to do that sort of thing. I remember guiding my wife through a couple of thunderstorms. She was my wife at the time, but as she went from her home near Abilene to school at Texas A&M, it's about a 4-hour drive, and there are a couple of spots that a couple of times she's calling me on the phone. What's coming? What am I driving into? So James, that's a hearty two thumbs up from Kevin and me. And in any way, he also commented about the weather hats episode from last week. It was a lot of fun. The email from we have a Mike Cox who is a radio guy in Tennessee and that listens to the program. Now we have a Micah Cox from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Majored in Oklahoma or majored in Oklahoma, majored in meteorology. Is now a GIS analyst in Oklahoma City and wants to find perhaps a dream job at some point where he's doing weather and GIS and certainly a lot of that out there. And really appreciate
the show. Don't send us any more emails. Your name makes it too confusing.
Yeah. Well, speak for yourself, Kevin. So listens to the show, appreciates it, and we appreciate your listening as well. He says, don't overthink or overproduce it. Just let the show develop naturally. This isn't broadcast TV or radio. Just do your thing. Mm-hmm. And nobody could accuse us of doing anything other than that. A listener survey from Daniel, a listener in Germany or from Germany, from Deutschland, although he currently lives in Bucharest in Romania, listens weekly to the show from his iPod. We have a small contingent of listeners in Estonia, Daniel.
Yes.
So if you make your way over to the Eastern Bloc, you can go check him out. I suggest a pick of the week, an old-fashioned book that he discovered in a library. It's called The Extraordinary Cloud Skies of the Unexpected, From the Beautiful to the Bizarre by Richard Hamlin of the UK Met Office. So pretty cool there. So pick of the week, and we appreciate that you're sending picks as well. If you have a link, you can send that to us, and we'll post it.
I wonder if Daniel knows about the Cloud Appreciation Society. He would probably like that.
Probably would. I'd imagine so.
Google that, Daniel. Are you a member? I'm a member of that.
I'm not. But
we've had Gavin Prater-Penny on the show, nice fellow, and he just does some great work. So I can't remember the way I said. Just Google Cloud Appreciation Society; it'll come up.
Yep. So anyway, we have that. We also have one other one from Jonathan in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, is with the University of Alabama, and sent us a click or a link. I'll click on it and then see if we can share it. We'll also post it as well. But let's see if we can get that to do a little bit of screen sharing action. Yeah, they keep moving the buttons and everything for
When they add features,
this bloody thing. So I can't figure out. So now I'm clicked onto something else. I just want to screen share. It's really not that hard. So let's see.
You're saying that, we should give a plug to Google Hangouts, though. I mean, I resisted I resisted doing the video on this show, and it was largely because I didn't want to. I'm not opposed to doing the video. I just didn't.
Yes, you are, and that's okay.
No, I didn't want it to turn into a thing where we were constantly playing to the camera, because then that was no good for the audio listeners. And it took Bill 6 months to stop holding books up in front of the camera. But that was kind of my main objection. But Google Hangouts, you know, for just hanging out with your friends, or really, they've been doing a lot of advertising, you know, on family type things. And there's some really nice ads and some stories coming around about what people are doing, you know, across the country or across the world where they're connecting with people. And we've doing this program since what, July or something, over Google Hangouts. And if you don't have an account, get in there and play with it. It's really, you know, it takes a few minutes to get used to it, but you can't break anything on it. You just get in there and start fooling around, and it can be quite a good experience. So that's not my pick of the week, but that's my plug.
Well, you bought me enough time to actually pull this up, and it's a BC comic from about a week ago, or this past Sunday, and you see one big snowflake, and it says, looks like another freak snowstorm, and it goes through and say, what do you got for me, Squirt? I got some dice. We'll roll them out, and then they turn that into a weather lab, and there will be anywhere from 4 to 6 inches of snow tonight. We've all, I think, been accused of that at some point. We actually, at my last station, we joked that we had the weather dice.
Yes.
The engineers would come and ask us to come and load the weather dice for them and come up with something interesting. So anyway, that is all of the email we have. If you want to send us a note, you can do that. Email at weatherbrains.com. You can tweet at weatherbrains. You can find our Facebook page. Also, if you go to weatherbrains.com, you can fill out the listener survey. Give us your opinion on what you think we're doing well, what you think we're doing poorly, et cetera, et cetera. We love to hear it. We had one that didn't care for the show actually a couple weeks ago and responded to his comments. I'm not sure he's listening still after that, but you know how that goes. But get in touch with us.
He's entitled to his opinion.
That's right. We love to hear from you. And by the way, I don't know if you saw, but The Onion ran a story about how Punxsutawney Phil was beheaded for the bad forecast early this season.
I saw some of that go by and I was like, what? That's got to be Onion material, because I didn't read a lot of it, but that makes sense now that you say that's what
that was. Of course it's The Onion.
All right.
And that's all I got, man.
Of course. You got a pick of the week? Let's do that.
Oh, I do. And it is totally not weather related.
Okay.
But being a child of the 80s that I am, I love this. So let's see if we can get the screen share. And this is my dream car. They have taken the old classic DeLorean from Back to the Future. You can now get that with an electric engine. So it's an electric car, has a range of 100 miles, and it's going to cost you about $1,000 a mile for the car. It's $95,000 list price for one of those things. And if I had it, I would buy one tomorrow. I love this.
We can make it weather related. Would a stainless steel vehicle be less, would it be more hail dent resistant?
Well, you bang them out. But, you know, of course, I mean, it is weather related because you get struck by lightning in order to make it go. You know, it's 1.21 gigawatts.
1 gigawatts, yeah.
What the hell is a gigawatt? Anyway, but I just, you know, this is the first time I think, you know, most people, and obviously the in-dash CD player, DVD player with the LCD screen was not an original stock part. But some of this stuff, you know, some of the detail of the insides of these DeLorean cars with the gull wings and everything else, that's just too cool.
Very cool indeed. I've got yet another Kickstarter project. Was it last week we did mentioned the Thermodo? Mm-hmm. And I actually been in email communication with those guys. They're in Copenhagen, but they did express an interest in coming on the show. And I said, well, we do the show live, so it's going to be like 3:30 in the morning. And
I haven't heard back from them.
Yeah, he knew that, and he said he would. And again, I haven't heard back. I know they're real busy because the Kickstarter project for them was real successful. And so on Kickstarter, that one is Thermodo. But here's a new one that came across today. It's only got 213 backers so far. The dollars, no, it's not dollars, it's in pounds, I guess. Their goal is 20,000. They've got a little over 4,500, still about a month to go. But it is a wireless anemometer that plugs into the phone. And there's
Did I not mention that last week? Did I not say we need one of those?
Oh, yes, you asked for it. I know. And somebody put it, and I should give credit. I'll see if I can find it before we get done. But somebody put it in my Google Plus stream.
Nice.
And it's, I'm not sure what to, they don't have a name for the thing. Well, my link's going to be on weatherbrains.com. But it's a, it's called, the title of it is a wireless wind meter containing no electronics. And they actually explain that in their little video. They're using magnets in the thing that interacts with the phone. So I think it's going to be pretty cheap because it's just a magnet and some plastic and a little jack that goes into the phone, a little, little eighth inch jack. So that's pretty cool. And they're, you know, they're, backer level starts at like 15 or 20 pounds. So another pretty cool one, but you can have a thermometer and an anemometer in your phone, which is pretty cool.
Can you have them simultaneously is the question.
I wonder, well, no, there's only one jack in the phone, but that now I'm seeing here that it's Copenhagen, Denmark. I wonder if it's the same guys. There's no indication that it is, but a lot of weather stuff, cool weather stuff going on in Copenhagen. We need to open a Copenhagen brand. We need to get Tarmo. Tarmo, go over and do some reporting from Copenhagen. That can't be too far away.
And we need to use all of the money that we've accumulated over the years to take a field trip, right?
Yeah, yes, that's a good idea.
All the hundreds of pennies.
All right, well, we shouldn't go on too, but you want to roll around this dot weather thing for a few minutes? We should. We need more guys to complain about that, but you and I can talk about it for a minute.
You know, I... This is one of those things. It's kind of like the naming winter storms that it's a, if you're the Weather Channel, this is brilliant. And I, you know, the, my second reaction, my first reaction was, oh my God, what are they doing? My second reaction was, why didn't I think of that?
Right.
Because it's not a top level domain that exists already. It's something that it appears that they're going out to try and have ICANN. And I used to know what that stands for, but it's the group that manages all of those top-level domains, the .com, .net, .org, and then all the new ones, .biz and .xxx and some of the other ones.
Right.
And one of the things that, you know, as I sort of get over the outrage of that, I mean, it's a brilliant, again, it's a brilliant marketing idea, just like, you know, when they went out and bought weather.com. And if you're the Weather Channel, it's brilliant. The problem is the Weather Channel isn't the only group that does weather. You have, in, at least in the United States, you have the National Weather Service, you have AccuWeather, you have, you know, a bunch of television stations. And I have to think that at some point, the AMS is going to have to get involved and say, you know, we want you to make a buck and we want you to, you know, to be profitable. We have no problem with that. But at some point, we have to come back and say, you know, this is something that the community needs to govern. And it can't just be one corporate entity that owns everything dot weather. And I'm pretty sure I haven't had a chance to go back and look at all of them, but I'm pretty sure this would be the only one of these top level domains that would potentially be owned by a single corporate entity.
There's no way they can get it.
Given the, you know, the sort of non-commercial beginnings of the internet, I mean, I remember being on the internet back in the days when you couldn't sell anything on the internet. When .com was really just a, oh, here's our page and here's how to get a hold of our email addresses, but you couldn't do any commerce on the internet, and how that gradually but overwhelmingly became not the case. And now that's the way a lot of people do business. So I still think enough of those non-commercial routes are in there. I don't know that the Weather Channel is going to, you know, eventually be successful with that. They already have the Australian government, you know, crawling up, you know, filing a formal objection to this proposal.
There's no way. I mean, this is all part of the marketing hype that's going on. And as you accurately said, you know, I mean, if you were a marketer, you're applauding these guys for the last, you know, year at least, because they're just hitting on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I've expressed my opinion on it. I think they're all brilliant. I think they're very smart marketing people. I just find it unfortunate that, you know, it just doesn't seem to me that a lot of ethics is creeping into that, which I think is unfortunate. But again, they're brilliant. There's no way they can get it, because it would open up such a big can of worms. I mean, the equivalent would be if Apple decided they wanted dot computer. They just can't do that. There's no way, because then you're into this land race like you had when even just words for .coms were going, you know, I mean, we've now registered all of the words, but you get this land rush going on. And I guess maybe, you know, it makes some money for ICANN, but it sure creates a lot of problems. I just don't see how any rational organization could allow that to happen with the Weather Channel. Not because I'm against the Weather Channel. I'm not. I just don't see that that makes good policy going forward, because then you've got to, you know, do, you know, dot everything, which is really going to cause a problem.
Yeah, the Weather Channel, I think the Australians' objection was that it's too generic, that dot weather is just such a generic term that if they allowed a corporate entity to register such a generic word like weather in a particular language, that the floodgates would be open, like you said, and we wind up having to do, you know, everything would be registered, and you'd have another squatting rush, you know, for that. But
yeah, I do think it's funny, though, that AccuWeather complains, given the history there, of not wanting, you know, the National Weather Service to do certain things. It's just kind of a, you know, here it comes around 360 type of thing. It's quite something.
Yep.
All right. Well, I guess we've solved that problem, right?
Yeah, we'll move on. We can cure cancer here at this point. Do we have enough time for that, or we need to punt that to next week?
Probably need to punt that to next week. And Bill's not here to tell us what's coming up. What is coming up? Do you know? He does such a good job doing that. I don't know. That's all right. We'll figure it out, and people will come anyway. So let's do the usual outros, or all the social media stuff is...
Give me a second. I can actually pull up the calendar. Well,
I'll do the pre-outro, and you can pull that up. All the social media stuff is at weatherbrains.com. Our email address is there as well. That's how you can get in touch with us. Show notes are there as well. Big history of the program. You want to go back in time, you can check that also. I believe starting next week, are back on a Monday schedule. We've been on Tuesday nights at 8:30 Central Time for the past couple of weeks, and I think this is the last one of those. So,
I think so as well.
Check your local listings, but I'm pretty sure we're going to be on 8:30 Central Time on Monday, where we'll stream it at live at bigbrainsmedia.com. The video version will be on weatherbrains.com, as will the audio version. And I think that's it. Did you find the schedule?
I do. I have the schedule right here. So we had Chuck Doswell this week. Greg Nordstrom will be on our guest next week. And as you said, it'll be Monday night instead of Tuesday night. Glenn Hurricane Schwartz from Philadelphia will be on here in a couple of weeks on Monday, April the 1st. Monday, April 8th, Bill Rhee, the former director of the National Hurricane Center, always a good interview. That's one of those pencil-in. Awesome. I mean, the rest of them will be good, but Bill, now that he's retired officially from federal service, will be even freer in his comments, I'm sure. But always a really good time to have him on the show. Julie Crockett from BYU talking about internal waves, and John Knox will be on in the end of April, the 22nd. So a lot of good content coming on in the next few weeks.
Very good. Well, James is not back, so let's go ahead and wrap it up. So neither you nor I is James Spann. Have a great week, and God bless.